Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. As I mentioned earlier, Utah, according to a point-in-time count conducted annually and recently, Utah has 15,642 people who are homeless. Some of those temporarily homeless, others chronically homeless. Utah has a program whereby the goal is to reduce chronic homelessness to zero by the year 2014. State officials say they are making progress with the housing programs and other programs. Many of us don't know quite how to approach the homeless, what to do as we encounter people who are homeless. We're going to talk about homelessness on the program today with Pamela Atkinson, leading advocate for the Utah's homeless, who joins us on the telephone. Pamela Atkinson, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Thank you very much.
And in studio with me is Leon Anderson, who's head of USU's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology, co-author of a book, Down on Their Luck, a Study of Homeless Street People. And he'll give the timepiece titled Criminalization of Mental Illness and the Promise of Mental Health Courts at the College of Humanities and Social Sciences Kiger Hour. That's on Thursday at 5:15 at Hamilton's Steak and Seafood in North Logan. Professor Anderson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me start with Pamela Atkinson. Of course, we've known that you've definitely done a lot of good with regard to the homeless, instrumental in founding and continuing the road home, for example. How did you get into to working with homeless?
When we were living in Seattle one Christmas holiday season, there was a PSA on the radio asking people to volunteer on Christmas Day to serve homeless people a Christmas dinner. So my family and I went down there, and I was just so intrigued by the individuality of the homeless people with whom I interacted, and so started to explore more there. And then when we moved here to Salt Lake, I got involved with the Salvation Army, and then have become part of many teams of agencies and people serving homeless people.
And Leon Anderson, I know you, for this book, you and your co-author basically lived with the homeless for a year, like in Austin, right?
Yes, that was in Austin. Actually, my experience with homelessness goes back quite a bit further than that. When I was a child, I was raised near Seattle, on about a block away from a railroad track that brought people from Seattle on over to Western Washington to the apple orchards. And as a child, I had a lot of occasions to see men who were part of that migrant workforce coming through. Oftentimes they would come by our house asking for food. Oftentimes my brother and I would go out to spend time just talking to them. And so over the years, I found myself riding freight trains around the country when I was young, and met a whole group of people who, itinerant workers, homeless, hobos, whatever. But it was years later that I ended up in the sociology program at the University of Texas at Austin. And it was, interestingly, a time of urban growth in Austin. And yet, at that time of urban growth, the number of homeless people was increasing dramatically in the city for a variety of reasons that we can talk about today. But it was interesting to me that a period of economic growth actually brought homeless people in looking for jobs. So we were asked by the city council and the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health at the University of Texas to go out and learn something about the homeless people who were on the streets of Texas, or on the streets of Austin at that time.
Hmm. We are talking with Leon Anderson from USU, Pamela Atkinson, longtime advocate for the homeless. You're welcome to join this conversation. Hope that you will if you have a question or comment. And during this hour, we won't hit you up for a donation on our fund drive. 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or an email to us from our at the following address, upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. I want to get into causes of homelessness and some of the ins and outs, but first of all, the interactions. I think a lot of us, maybe our hearts go out to people we don't know quite what to do. And Pamela Atkinson, I was touched by an anecdote that you told in a Deseret News article I was reading, that you volunteered at a, I think it was a Salvation Army event, and the gentleman assigned you to the door. He said, shake their hands as they come in. And indicated that that's maybe the first physical contact they would have had from anyone for quite some time.
Well, that's absolutely right. It was a major in the Salvation Army, and he said that maybe the first time they've been touched in a week if you shake their hands. And I think we sometimes forget to look at homeless people as individuals. Many of them have goals and dreams, much as we are, and this one man, after I'd shaken his hand, Peter, he actually came from New York, and he'd had relatives back in Utah. But he told me that when I shook hands with him, that was the first time he'd been touched in a year. And he also told me that sometimes when he stood on the street, not quite knowing where to go or what to do, people who walked by would avert their eyes from him. And that made him feel like a non-person, as though he didn't exist. And I think the more I've talked with my homeless friends over the last 20 years, the more I've learned about how very much alike we all are. Many people in society have suffered through abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse as children, mental illness, and that is exactly what we find in our amongst our homeless friends. They've gone through many of the same traumas. It's just that they haven't received the necessary help with their problems, and that's how we got into the housing first program and trying to end chronic homelessness, because of those interactions and the stories we heard from our homeless friends.
Leon Anderson, you have similar stories, I know, in the book. People won't make eye contact. They'll even go to the other side of the street to avoid homeless people.
Yeah, one of the things that impressed us in spending time with the homeless in Austin, Texas, was just the tremendous social psychological impact of being a person who is looked down on all the time and often subject to a lot of what we would call attention deprivation. I mean, we're all very social animals. Part of what makes us feel good about ourselves or even keep ourselves together is a sense of other people having some interest in us, other people paying attention to us. And so, as Pamela said, you know, a person who hasn't been touched in a year, that's a tremendous social psychological burden. I mean, we can talk all we want about, and hopefully we will some, about mental illness among the homeless, but just being homeless itself is a tremendously mentally stressful condition and you know, can cause problems as well as be the cause of those problems.
Mm-hmm. Pamela Atkinson, I was also reading you keep dog food in your car as you go out and visit your homeless friends. I think that's a recognition that some homeless people have pets, and that's the only affection they're going to get.
Well, I'd just like to jump in and see if Pam has had this experience as well. But one of the things that I found interesting, particularly on the park blocks next to the University of Texas, where many of the homeless would spend time either panhandling or just hanging out, a number of those people had pets. And one of the functions of those pets was very similar to what you see in dog parks and college student dating. The presence of that pet was a way that someone could give attention to something related to them and maybe give them a little bit of attention as well. So those pets serve not only as a source of affection for them, but also they facilitate their interaction with other people.
Interesting. Have you found that as well, Pamela Atkinson?
Well, actually, yes. I think Leon's absolutely right. I think for many of my homeless friends and formerly homeless friends who have dogs, that is the only love that they get. And I found myself drawn into this service now that anybody who has a dog or even a cat, if they're homeless or low income, that I help the person take care. For instance, on my team, there's a vet at the Town and Country Vet Hospital. He'll take care of these dogs and cats and gives me a 20% discount. And then I also have an animal overnight stay where if there's a family who's homeless, we find them in the car, and the reason they haven't come into the shelter is because they have a dog and the children don't want to see that dog put to sleep. But then we'll find a place for the animal to stay, and owners always give me a discount. And then the family can go into the shelter and get the necessary case management. But I think if you look at the relationship between a homeless person and their dog, there is such a love between them because dogs don't judge people. Dogs don't look at homeless people and say, oh, my goodness, you're homeless. I don't want to be your dog. Dogs love unconditionally, and I think that's something that humans can honestly learn from this relationship with animals. And I just love seeing somebody's face light up when I say, do you need some dog food? And even when people are off the streets and now in the supportive housing, I have some friends whom I've known for 15 years on the streets. They're now in this supportive housing and they have dogs. So I'm committed to them that I will continue to bring the dog food by and dog treats. And they are meticulous in keeping their animals well brushed and keeping, you know, picking up after them when they've gone to the bathroom. And it's, you see the beginning of the relationships that they have with their dogs that they can then start to have with other human beings as they get counseling.
We're talking with Pamela Atkinson, who's a longtime advocate for the homeless in Utah, and with Leon Anderson, who is a professor of sociology and head of USU's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology. Leon Anderson will be giving the timepiece. It's a lecture at the College of Humanities and Social Sciences Kiger Hour on Thursday. It's 5:15 at Hamilton Steak and Seafood in North Logan. It's titled Criminalization of Mental Illness and the Promise of Mental Health Courts. He's co-author of Down on Their Luck, A Study of Homeless Street People. You're welcome to join this conversation on homelessness at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. I want to talk about causes of homelessness. Start with Pamela Atkinson on this. You've talked to many people over the years. I imagine each story is as individual as the individual itself, but there must be some general themes as to why people end up on the streets.
One of the areas that we've not been very good at in the past, but we're doing better now, is we haven't broken the cycle of homelessness. And what stays in my mind is that a number of years ago in the family shelter, I met a 14-year-old who just had a baby 2 weeks prior to my meeting up with her. And as we talked, and she finally said to me, I remember you. And I said, well, you look familiar. And it turned out that 7 years prior to us meeting then, I had met her when she was a child of seven in a family that was homeless. And we learned some valuable lessons from her story. But the causes of homelessness go right back to what Leon's such an expert in, the mental illness that is not recognized and treated, the poverty that they haven't been able to get out of poverty. We have so many people who are near homeless, and many of us step in to try and prevent homelessness occurring in the first place. We do have people who fail academically because they haven't had the right help. They don't get any help at home. They're not getting extra help in school, so they become school dropouts. We have people who get into gambling, people who get into drugs, alcohol, and there is not one cause of homelessness. There's multiple problems that can cause homelessness, and therefore it's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of treatment. But the one thing we have learned over the last six or seven years is you can't just put people in treatment and then look for housing. And that's why we now have the Housing First program. If people are off the street and safe in housing, then we can offer them the treatment they need to deal with these multiple problems they may well have.
And Professor Anderson, I want to have you talk about mental illness and mental illness health courts. But in the book, it struck me as Mrs. Atkinson was talking about this, once you're in a homeless situation, there's a series of catch-22s, that if I could have one factor, for example, if I had an address, I could get a job, but if I don't have a job, I can't get an address. And you, there were several people who talked about that with you.
Yes, there certainly were people who were trying to do things right, but finding that the situation they were in presented roadblocks to doing that. But I'd like to come back just briefly to what Mrs. Atkinson mentioned, and that is poverty. Now, I mean, poverty is a financial thing, but poverty is also reflected in many ways in the wealth of family connections and the ability of families to help assist people. And one of the things that causes homelessness is a lack of that social and economic margin, so that one bad thing happens, a car accident that you or I or Mrs. Atkinson could weather. Even if we were injured, we would have the support and the base for being able to not lose our homes over that. But for people who are managing on that precarious edge, one little thing, a flat tire, make it so you are unable to get to a job, and it just cascades from there. I mean, the number of times it seems like one little thing kind of catapulted the person into homelessness, but it was in the context of a bigger picture of a set of resources that people of the bottom of the social hierarchy often don't have. The other thing that goes on is that many of the things that we see as causes of homelessness may in fact be results of homelessness as well. And certainly in our work, one of the things that we found, for instance, was that homeless people tended to, over time, engage in drinking and substance abuse at higher levels, in part, as they often say, in the medical field, to self-medicate for a very hopeless kind of stressful social life. So I think it's important to recognize that as well.
You have a story. I wonder you tell this. There's a gentleman in the book. I think he's in Mississippi, and he's heard there are greener pastures in Austin. He does have some resources, has a car or a truck, but it's a series of cascading events that renders him homeless.
Okay. Well, there's one particular gentleman who came from Killeen, Texas. He had been in the military. He was himself a in foster care through basically all of his childhood, he and his siblings. But he went into the military, got out of the military in Killeen, Texas, and got an old big Cadillac with the money he had, drove on down to Austin because he was convinced there was work down there, and he had experience in the roofing trade. He got down there, and I actually met Doug because he ended up sleeping on the roof of the apartment complex I was living in. He came down, looked for an opportunity to get work. He got work, but unfortunately, the person who hired him didn't pay him for much of the work. And his license plates on his car were out of date, and he started getting tickets for the car because he was driving it around to get to work. Well, as he did that, he ended up spending some time in jail, and over time, trying to find work, selling a lot of plasma, he became very emaciated. And so one day he was at the plasma center hoping to get a chance to sell some blood, and he'd put rocks in his pockets so that he weighed enough to be able to donate. And when they found that out, they told him he couldn't donate. He complained. They called the police, and that evening I ended up visiting Doug in jail, where, interestingly, one of the booking sergeants had offered to buy his car from him at a very low price. Mm-hmm. But Doug took it because that was one of the few things. But that kind of cascading set of incidents certainly played out there. Mm-hmm.
Pamela Atkinson, I wonder if you could tell me about one or two of your homeless friends. Put a face to this. You have many friends, I'm sure.
I do, and I have homeless friends with there are just many faces amongst them. No two are alike. I love the fact that homeless people, the men, watch out for children very carefully. When Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped, nobody searched more for her than a lot of my homeless friends, and they took me to places that even the police didn't know about. And we had a celebratory dinner when she was found, and Elizabeth's aunt came and helped us celebrate too, because they were an integral part of that search. What I like is, it's always very emotional, is when a formerly homeless friend contacts me. It may be by phone, it may be hailing me on the street downtown, and they let me know that they now they have a job. There was one man, he was part of a camp. I do homeless outreach and with Volunteers of America, and we were out at this camp, and there were eight men in this one camp, and bitterly cold day, and they had a fire going in a big barrel, and all of their hands were just about blue, and they said none of them had gloves. So later that day, I went back with eight pairs of gloves, and eventually that camp broke up. But I was in, it was about a year later, I was in a residential place for men who were going through substance abuse treatment. And the manager who lived in there, he came towards me and he looked at me and smiled and said, "You don't recognize me, do you?" And I looked at this clean-shaven man with his sports jacket and slacks and looking very healthy, bright-eyed. He said, "I'm Bill from that 13th South camp." And then I remembered him, and he said, "Hold on a moment." And he ran up to his room, his little apartment at the top, came back down holding that one pair of gloves out of those eight that I had taken over there. He said, it is because of this pair of gloves and all the other things that you and other people did for me that I realized that it was worth it for me to keep living, that I actually did have some self-worth, some self-esteem. And he said, now I have this job and I'm going to school. And of course we hugged and cried and talked about the other people, who many of whom had died from alcoholism. But I think it was a great reminder that the small things that we do for people can help change their lives. And it's really this reaching out, being kind and acknowledging them as human beings. And we should never, ever underestimate the power of even a small amount of caring, whether it be a touch, a handshake, whether it be a smile, whether it be something that we donate to an agency for homeless people, because it truly does make a difference.
I wanted to, we're going to take a brief break and we'll be back. But before we do that, Leon Addison, I wanted to have you tell a story in the book, kind of the opposite example from what Mrs. Atkinson was talking about, but the kind of the thoughtless things people do sometimes. A couple of gentlemen you knew at a place where the homeless would congregate, and apparently on a regular basis, buses would come through with students.
Well, the sad thing is that, you know, children and many of the rest of us, if truth were told, carry some, fear and some carelessness and some heartlessness, and can reflect that in our interactions with homeless people. And one of the saddest things for me on the streets was that there was a school bus that regularly came by one of the spots that homeless people spent time at. And not uncommonly, students, and these were elementary school students, would have the windows down as they drove by. They would throw out pennies and yell, "Get a job! Get a job!" The children would have that kind of stereotype was really sad. But I also found on the positive side that by the time those students were college students, the college students I had interactions with, they carried some of the same stereotypes, but oftentimes they wanted to know, how can I talk to a homeless person? How can I reach out to that person? Older people far more interested in what we could do to help, but the young people in my experience wanted to know, how could I connect? How could I touch that person in interaction?
We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some more of the causes. We'll get into the mental illness factor, and we'll talk about some solutions. There is some good being done, progress in Utah being done to reduce chronic homelessness. Housing is a big part of that. And by the way, there's a new fund, the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund, which you can donate to on your taxes. We'll talk about those things and the crucial question, what can I do? What should I do? All that coming up with Pamela Atkinson and Leon Addison. Our topic is homelessness following the break.
I'm Victoria Rowe Berry, director of the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art at Utah State University. And I've been in Logan for the last 12 years. UPR is like my best friend. I listen to be informed. I find entertainment. And most important of all, I feel a part of a community. Life is better with UPR.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from S.E. Needham Jewelers in historic downtown Logan since 1896, specializing in diamond engagement rings and custom jewelry design, middle of the block at the sign of the clock. Information at seneedham.com.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our topic is homelessness on this part of the program. We're talking with a longtime advocate for Utah's homeless, Pamela Atkinson, and with Leon Anderson, who's department head of the Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology at Utah State University. His timepiece is titled Criminalization of Mental Illness and the Promise of Mental Health Courts, and that'll be given at the College of Humanities and Social Sciences Hour, CAGR Hour, on Thursday at 5:15 at Hamilton Steak and Seafood in North Logan. According to a recent point-in-time count, this happens every year. Utah has 15,642 people who are homeless. Some people are homeless just for a short while. Others are chronically homeless. And we've been talking about some of the causes, some of the solutions. We continue that discussion on the rest of the program, and you're welcome to join it at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Pamela Atkinson, quite an honor. The Homeless Trust Fund, which was set up, that bears your name. I imagine that's very pleasing.
Well, it is actually. It used to be the Utah State Homeless Trust Fund. And then when the Speaker, Marty Stevens, some years ago, he put a bill through the House and Senate to change it to my name. It truly is an honor because people usually have things named after them after they're dead. And, you know, periodically I check my pulse to make sure I'm still breathing. It's given the trust fund some publicity. Mm-hmm. We do have billboards up right now, courtesy of Reagan billboards, and showing myself with two children who were homeless, and the slogan is, no child should be tucked into a car at nighttime. And we're trying to draw to the attention to the fact that there are many different faces of homeless people. There are children, there are families. In fact, the fastest growing population in the homeless population are the single parents with children under six. Mm. But people can donate with their tax returns, basically $2 or more on line 21A on their state tax form, and people, you know, give $100, $200, but many people give between $2 and $5. And even after the taxes are all filed, people can still give throughout the year. But it has drawn awareness to the fact that there are young families who are homeless, and these are people who very often we haven't been able to prevent homelessness occurring because of some catastrophic events, such as Leon mentioned. But we have found that by getting people who are homeless, you take families who became homeless because of the recession, losing jobs, losing their savings, that if we can have them in the shelter, get them case management, very often if things turn around and we can help them get a job, they can be back in their own apartment within 3 to 4 weeks of becoming homeless. Mm. Those, of course, are the people who are not chronically homeless. Mm. But the money that we get through the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund, it goes for case management. It goes for emergency shelter. It's just amazing that case managers, the work they do with homeless people to help them realize what led to them being homeless, what do they want to do, what are their goals, helping them set goals and helping them achieve those goals. So when people just give the $2, $3, or $4, that combined with dollars given throughout the state by people surely does turn people's lives around.
I wonder if you could expand on what you said earlier about the Housing First program. I think this addresses that catch-22 that many homeless people are in. They could get a job if they had an address. They can't get an address because they don't have a job. You have to get them into housing first, I think we've found, and then get them the treatment.
Absolutely. We did it the other way around for so many years, but then I think it was President Bush who came up with this initiative to end chronic homelessness by 2014. And although chronic homeless people were only 10 to 15% of the homeless population, they were using 90% of the resources. So we now have these various supportive housing buildings. Let me talk about Palmer Court. It's an old Holiday Inn on Main Street, downtown Salt Lake, that was purchased with the help of private money and state money and federal monies and different foundations. It has 201 studio apartments and some two-bedroom apartments, and it has formerly chronically homeless families. There are 60 families there, and then single men and single women. They're expected to keep their apartments clean. They get case management and counseling. There's a Head Start program there for the younger kids. The school bus stops there to pick up the kids, and as it does at the shelter, the school bus stops there first, and then the kids are dropped off last. And this is done so that the kid's identity is not immediately picked up by the other children who say, oh, they're homeless. And it isn't until they're well absorbed into the schools that children begin to realize these children did not have a good start in life. But we have 201 apartments there. Sunrise Metro has 100 for apartments. We have Grace Mary Manor, and then there are others being built and coming on board throughout the state. And we think that with the progress these men and women and the children have made, some of them now have jobs, working part-time. Many of them have got the treatment they needed for their chemical abuse or their mental illness. We think that by 2014, we will certainly be able to have all of the chronically homeless people who are willing to be off the street and getting the necessary treatment and counseling that they need.
Professor Anderson, you have a unique perspective, interesting perspective on the mental illness side of this. I was reading in your biography with the timepiece here, you were a research fellow with Ohio Department of Mental Health during those years following the closing of that state's mental hospitals. This is something that happened in many states, I think.
It was a national occurrence, and to really look at this, it's amazing. And I know last year you had a chance to interview Pete Early, who has written a book on this issue. But in 1841, a young woman, Sunday school teacher Dorothea Dix, went to the Cambridge, Massachusetts jail to do a Sunday school lesson for women there, and found that many of the women she saw there were, in her mind, not suffering or were not criminals so much as suffering from mental illness. And Dorothea Dix began a national effort, very successful effort, to build mental asylums for the mentally ill around the United States. In Utah, the first one, the Utah Insane Asylum, as it was called at that time, was opened in 1885 in Provo. Between the late 1800s through to the 1950s, we moved to have 232 mental hospitals around the country with 700,000 beds. Now, the abuses that went on in those large mental hospitals are legendary now. And that, in part, as well as the cost of running them, led to President Kennedy in 1963 proposing the Community Mental Health Centers Act. That act was planned as a way to move people into community-based care. Unfortunately, while we did close the mental asylums, the Utah Insane Asylum, as it was originally called, was dismantled in 1981. Around the country, between 1956 and the early 1990s, we went from 560,000 people in mental hospitals to 90,000. But what we didn't do a good job of was providing the community care that they needed. And there were two parts to that care, probably. One was just having the services available. The other part was coordinating those services so that people could access them. But as those mental hospitals were closed, the question today is, where are the people who are in those mental hospitals? And a lot of them were elderly people suffering from dementia, who are now in nursing homes. And that was a very successful kind of transinstitutionalization, moving from one kind of institution to another. A lot of those people who were younger ended up being, first of all, thrust back on their families for support, and when families were thin, ending up on the streets. That's what we think of as deinstitutionalization. In Austin, Texas, I was doing field work with the homeless, and the major of the Salvation Army, I was at the Salvation Army one day, the major came and said, you have to come see this with me. He took me to the front of the Sally, and there was a van from the Texas Psychiatric Hospital letting six people out, six souls who just, you know, stood there lost, who had been brought right to the homeless shelter from the mental hospital. But the other place that, and this has a lot to do with homelessness as well, the other place that mentally ill people have ended up is in the jails and prisons in U.S. society. And clearly, all of the good data that we have document that in many ways, prisons and jails have become the new asylums for the mentally ill. And by all counts, they are very pitiful places to treat the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the message that I want to make sure we get out, as well as the promises that go along with mental health courts.
An unfortunate full circle from what Dorothea Dix found.
If she were in the at the start of the 21st century, to be able to come back and go to the same places that she fought against early on, she would have seen the same problem repeating itself 170 years later.
Mm-hmm. Pamela Atkinson, I'm sure you see some of the same things, people who are mentally ill end up on the streets and end up in jails.
Well, they do, and it's very unfortunate that when they end up in jail. But in Utah, and particularly in Salt Lake City, we have an incredible relationship with the police, and they've had some wonderful instructions on how to work with homeless people. In fact, we have a program called HOST in Salt Lake City. It is Homeless Outreach Service Team, and it is the police themselves. And when they come across homeless people, whether they're panhandling or just sort of standing around, they will approach them and ask them if they can help them in any way. And these police carry a list of the homeless service providers who have signed up for the project. I'm on the list if somebody has a pet who's sick and needs vet care, or who they need dog food. But this teamwork with the police has enabled us to keep track of those who are mentally ill and end up in jail. So we can go visit the people in the jail. Occasionally I've posted bail when necessary. But to be able to visit and find out and educate the police what is going on, I think has made a huge difference in many people's lives, particularly if that person is not taking their medication. We work with Valley Mental Health and their homeless program that's called The Storefront, and people from The Storefront, they go out with us on homeless outreach, and I think what I find here, not so much in other states, is the incredible collaboration that we have statewide. Our Ending Chronic Homeless program, we are statewide, whereas many of the programs are just cities-wide, like Denver and Philadelphia and New York and Seattle. But we're a small enough state, we can do it statewide. But I do think the cooperation, collaboration of the police and working as part of our team has made a huge difference in how we are treating the mentally ill here.
If you've just joined us, we have another 5 minutes left. Our topic is homelessness, and we're talking with Leon Anderson, head of USU's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology, co-author of Down on Their Luck, A Study of Homeless Street People, and with Pamela Atkinson, leading advocate for Utah's homeless. Starting with Mrs. Atkinson, I want to ask each of you, this is a question that I personally have, and maybe I'm representative of some of our listeners. Of course, my heart goes out to homeless people that I encounter, but I kind of feel stuck. I don't know quite how to reach out. I have some fears, of course, like a lot of people do. I wonder, Pamela Atkinson, what would your advice to me be if I encounter a homeless person?
When one encounters a homeless person, one, of course, knows nothing about that person. And you, to be quite honest, in this area, there is a criminal element amongst the homeless, a very small element, but they're there. I think the best that a person can do is to acknowledge that person, just to say hi and walk on. Stopping to engage the person, one can do that, but one does not know if that person is truly homeless or anything about them. To really get involved and work with homeless people, one needs to work with the agencies that serve them. And if somebody wants to volunteer to assist with homeless people and assist on the many projects we're all involved in, all they have to do is to call 211. That's a statewide information and referral, a volunteer center. They can find out what are the services available in which they can help in the area in which they live.
Hmm. Leon Anderson, this same question. You had encounters with homeless people for a very intense period, for a year. What would your advice to me be? I encounter a homeless person. What should I do?
Well, I think much of what Pamela said is very appropriate. I think that the key thing is to think about, okay, so I'm having an interaction with this homeless person. What's the bigger context? What's the bigger social environment that this is part of? And if I truly want to have an impact, what can I do? Certainly supporting agencies in any variety of ways, be it hands-on, be it financially. They're a great cadre of committed service providers out there. But also supporting groups like the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is a family support group that helps family members learn coping strategies for dealing with family members who have problems, who might end up homeless, who might end up incarcerated. But certainly, I mean, Pamela pointed to police officers. There are two groups, I think, more than any, who get hit with the impact of homelessness. One is law enforcement officers, and the crisis intervention training that they're receiving today has moved us light years ahead in terms of how to relate to people suffering from mental illness who are engaged in some kind of public disorderly conduct. Critically important. But for those who are then arrested, the judges also play a role. And we're very lucky in the state of Utah to have a good set of mental health courts. These are courts that didn't exist much more than 10 years ago. And now 40 states around the country have mental health courts. Ways to help people look at or people who have been arrested and suffering from mental illness get incentives to take care and get the services they need to help them avoid the kinds of problems we've been talking about today.
And we just have 30 seconds left. Pamela Atkinson, what would your final word be, especially advice to people who want to help?
Get involved with a group of people who are already working with homeless people, like serving meals. And when you're part of a group, that fear quickly dissipates and you start to learn more about individual homeless people. And the fact that when you serve them with a meal or a pair of gloves, they say thank you most often.
Well, we're out of time. We have been talking with Pamela Atkinson, a leading advocate for Utah's homeless. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Leon Anderson is head of USU's Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology, and co-author of Down on Their Luck, a study of homeless street people. He'll give the timepiece titled Criminalization of Mental Illness and the Promise of Mental Health Courts at the College of Humanities and Social Sciences Kiger Hour. That's on Thursday at 5:15 at Hamilton Steak and Seafood in North Logan. Professor Anderson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And again, that number you can call to find out volunteer opportunities, including with the homeless, 211 is the number to call. And our topic tomorrow will include repression of activism in Burma. There's a new film that's out in Salt Lake City, and also a retrospective on photographers of the civil rights movement. That's the program tomorrow. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.